كان صعب.
Here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure.
And nobody could hear me say my side of it because my microphone was turned off.
Well, mine was a little bit on the down. You want to do it again?
Sure.
Okay. Let's do it. Once more under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, I said it in case you didn't. Right.
Yeah. In case I wasn't available to say my name.
Well, you never can tell. I mean, it's redundant all over again.
Yes. Repetitive and redundant.
Yes. And it's time for our disclosure and disclaimer. The disclosure is that the Personal Wealth Coach is not only a radio program that you are listening to or not, as the case may be, and if you're not, you're unaware of it.
I'm not listening, and I'm completely unaware as well.
True. And it is also the name of an investment advisory firm registered with the SEC that operates out of Salado, Texas, and does business in all kinds of interesting places with people to manage investment portfolios for people of higher net worth. And the information we give on here, despite the fact we are representatives of an investment advisory firm, we're the principals actually, is not investment advice. It is educational only because investment advice is dependent upon the circumstances of the individual. And the information we present on this program is obtained, has been obtained from sources we believe are very reliable and objective. But we make no warranty or guarantee as to its accuracy or completeness. I'm getting pretty good at this.
Accuracy or completeness.
Right.
So it could be completely inaccurate and incomplete.
Or it could be incompletely inaccurate.
It would be incompletely accurate or incompletely complete.
So seems like there ought to be an opposite of complete.
Incomplete.
Yeah, but incomplete is just...
You can use it as an adverb to talk about complete. It's incompletely complete.
Oh, okay.
How about unfinished?
Well, that's meanwhile, back at the ranch, we had an interesting week.
Yes.
It was not the standard week where the market goes up. It was a standard week where the market goes down. As a matter of fact, the Standard & Poor's 500 stock index was down 5.16% this last week. Now, it would have been down more, except that on Friday, it actually rose 1.5%. So, year-to-date, the Standard & Poor's 500 is down 2.02. The Dow is down 2.14.
Good those are news. Percentages or points?
Those are percentages. Okay. I always use percentages.
Right. Except when we don't.
I just use percentages.
Except when we don't.
When I make this report on the radio on Saturday mornings, I always use percentages because the numbers become a little silly. For instance, the Dow Jones Industrial Average closed out the week at 24,190.90. Those are too big of numbers to get in my brain. That's too much. I can only approximate 24,190.90. Now 5.21% down for the week. Yeah, I can get.
I can understand that.
That makes sense. The S&P 500, though, from 1 year ago, is still up 13%. The Dow's up about 19%. So it's not the end of the world, but you can see it from here.
I think the end of the world is present anywhere you are.
Yeah, but
it's just the upward end of the world. If you jump straight up, you have jumped off the planet momentarily.
Right.
You have jumped off the edge of the world. It's just the upward edge.
And you would have to jump really, really hard to reach escape velocity and keep going.
Oh, well, I mean, Tesla did it with a Roadster in a SpaceX rocket.
Right. That was more than a jump.
Yeah, it was kind of a push. It was a boost.
Yeah,
it was a big boost.
Yeah, it was a big boost. So we have had, actually, on Thursday at the close, and this is how these things are measured traditionally for some reason.
Because it's informal and we do it traditionally.
Right. We have things we call corrections and bear markets, and the tradition, the consensus appears to be that, although there's no official measurement, that once the broad market, meaning the Dow Jones Industrial Average or the S&P 500 or both, are down 10% from a high earlier reached, then we call that a correction. And if it gets down 20% or more than 20%, we call that a bear market.
Which, well, if you think about that just for a second, we all wish to be correct. We don't all wish to be bears. Why is it called a correction for being – it must be – it's now the market is now correct. We have been corrected.
This one actually – made
probably
a lot
is.
Of sense. This isn't actually.
It did make sense.
Corrections are commonly random events that just kind of happen, and it's quite a while later before anybody figures out why they happen.
I like your sound effect there. That was the whatever
it's
was.
It's just part of chaos. That's
the sound of a correcting market.
One of the things that's made people who analyze the market uncomfortable recently is the fact that we went 404 days without a single down 1% day. And that is pretty astonishing. And then we went down. Now we've gone down a lot more than that, obviously. But this is the point. A correction means that the market is the technical meaning. It doesn't necessarily hold up in every case. But a correction means that the market was overpriced a little bit. And there was a correction in the price because it didn't take something into account. And in this particular case, just to show how brilliant this supposedly highly efficient market is, it isn't, by the way.
It isn't efficient at all.
It isn't efficient, and it's not particularly brilliant. The tax bill that was passed last year that the market didn't seem to pay much attention to. I mean, we didn't see any fluctuations in the market after it was passed and signed into law, and we didn't see anything much in January out of it.
It's just continued
irrational
the kind
exuberance.
Of irrationally too steep yeah. rise.
But it finally struck home that the United States of America is going to have to borrow about $2 trillion more than it was otherwise going to have to borrow. And if it went to the market and the Treasury Department made it, what?
Oh, with the spending bill, it's
a lot more than that.
Let me get there.
Yeah. Let me get there. So that was the first downturn. And we had 2 days specifically a downturn. It went up a little bit, and then it went down seriously. Then the spending bill passed through Congress, and again, I don't think the traders in the market are paying a lot of attention to it until it passed. And this is something I haven't actually seen analysis in the news media on. But if you take the fact that we increased spending – some places say, and if I know that it officially is $300.
That's for this year, but it's a 2-year project.
Well, it's $300 million for 2 years.
Billion.
$300 billion for 2 years.
Not,
wait, hang on.
Not for two. Go ahead.
Let me finish this. But it also includes $90 billion for storm damage.
Yeah.
And so that's about $400 billion, and that is over 2 years. That's a 2-year budget they just came up with $400 billion for 2 years. Now, that's $200 billion a year. And since the tax bill was a 10-year deal and then it says we've spent so much money in 10 years that we can't afford to keep doing this. So then taxes revert back. Let's take the same 10-year period where we were going to spend $1.5 trillion that we are not taking in as taxes, more than we had planned to spend earlier. Throw in $200 billion a year for 10 years, and you don't have to get really smart to realize there's another $2 trillion there. Now, we wrote in the newsletters, that, because we actually had the sources for that, that it was that it basically $3 trillion was the total. Now, the other organizations are coming out and looking at the numbers, and they say, no, it's more like add $4 trillion to the national debt.
I would say it's more than that. Congressional Budget Office came out with a report that says that we're expected to borrow. We had been, according to them, expected to borrow $500 billion, $500 billion this year.
This year, yeah.
Instead, we're going to be $900 billion
this
year.
That's if nothing goes wrong.
And next year, they expect it to go from what they expected to be $700 billion to $1.9 trillion.
Yes.
Next year's deficit.
And if you want to know why the market took a stumble,
that's the reason.
Somebody realized that if you take $4 trillion, I'll just use that number because it's as good as any. And you don't take it out of the economy through taxes, but you borrow it, if the federal government borrows it and sticks it back into the economy in spending, then
in a relatively short period of time,
that's going to have, and this stuff is front-loaded the next 2 years, that's going to have a profound effect upon the money supply. It's going to have a profound effect upon wages.
Prices are going to go up. Wages are already going up.
Bond interest rates suddenly started upward. And the reason they started upward is in order for the government – by the way, two things happened at the same time there. One, the Treasury Department, which makes sense, says, hey, we're going to need to borrow one heck of a lot more money than we planned on borrowing before.
Yep.
Because we just cut taxes and increased spending a whole bunch. And so we're going to be borrowing a lot of money out there. Well, that causes interest rates to rise when somebody wants to borrow more money. And the other thing is – we start to see wages pick up because we're approaching or at full employment, which means wage rises are the heart and soul of inflation. And as inflation kicks in, bond interest rates will go up because people demand a certain interest rate, a certain amount of money just for loaning their money to you, plus what they anticipate going forward inflation will be. So it really boils down to the fact that the government is going to give away $4 trillion and the bond market's going to take it back.
Yeah.
And that made people nervous all of a sudden when they realized that this could get out of control in a hurry.
It was enough so that we had a very small additional government shutdown. So all of like 5 minutes of effect on the government,
right?
Because the payment just takes that long to do. So 5 minutes of actual fiscal shutdown. There were about 2 hours where the budget wasn't there, but it happened to be early in the morning, so there wasn't a lot of money moving around at the time. It's funny how that happens. Most of the time you don't wire things from one bank to another at 12 a.m. But in the middle of this, I want to point out some things to people that are that think that their political party has a platform, because it really doesn't. The platform that is any political party has changes very quickly when they're in power, and then when they're not in power, it changes to something else. So just I'll start with the Democrats. Democrats purport to be high spend, high tax, except that at times they are high spend, low tax. Just thinking of Bill Clinton's lowering of taxes at the same time of raising spending. Republicans are supposed to be low tax, low spend, except that when they get into power, they tend to lower taxes. Okay, that's kind of part of their platform. But then they raise spending. And if you just look back the last time that the Republicans held the House, the Senate, and the White House, we lowered taxes and raised spending. And now the U.S. government, again, has lowered taxes and raised spending. We have some real problems in trying to figure out who to vote for, because people aren't doing what they said they would do in either party. So keep that in mind when we're talking economics and we're looking at projections into the future on what the debt's going to be at the governmental level. We have to use these rough estimates. And the overall effect on the economy has a lot more to do with interest rates and inflation than it has to do with the stimulus effect. Because when the government spends money, it has roughly a one-for-one effect in the economy. It takes a tax dollar that was already in the economy and it puts it back in the economy. A private business takes money and makes new money with it.
But when it borrows money and puts into the economy, it just puts an extra dollar into the
economy. Right, that wasn't there before, and it wasn't something that actual value created. So in a small business, if you create something of value that people are willing to pay for, you can create new money without increasing inflation because the value is the same. When the government borrows money and puts it back into the economy, what it's doing is creating new money. That's kind of the definition of how money is created, is that new money borrowed and spent.
There's a And I know people don't generally think 2 or 3 years out, but we do. And
I think we've got a great long time horizon of 2 years, but it's infinitely longer than the government's.
Moody's Analytics has forecast the Great Recession, and they've been amazingly accurate in their forecast. When they forecast the GDP, it's been within about a quarter point of being correct. It's much more accurate than the Fed's forecast. So we are proud subscribers, and they have a very interesting analysis right now. They say that they expect that the combination of the spending bill and the tax cut will be stimulative to the economy in 2018, significantly stimulative to the economy in 2019.
Which is great.
And we will have a massive hangover in 2020.
Right. And that's the problem. We got to look out ahead. It's going to be really, really good for a short period of time. And we've been saying that for a while. I've got to throw this in there, too. We were talking about the correction. I've had a lot of people this week congratulate me on predicting the correction. And I have to come out and say, I did not predict the correction. People have been saying,
we just said one was coming.
Yeah, we said one was coming. We said we're due for one. And I did not predict that it would happen the week that it happened. We just happened to be talking about we were due for one that particular week. So just you know, I wish I could predict it that accurately, but we didn't.
All the great economic forecasters forecast the same thing over and over again, and when it finally happens, they make the headlines.
Yeah, well, for the record, most of them then come out and take great credit for being right. You know, of course I predicted it on that day. Of course I did. No, what we've got to say is, there's no way to predict on a given day when the correction, or given week, when the correction is going to happen. We can just look and say we're due for one at some point. It may be 2 years out. I would like it to be sooner. And people have also been calling me on that. What do you mean you would like a correction? We have a correction. It's not very fun. The reason why I say I would like it, and I do like that we've had this, is that as long as people recognize that the market is not a magic money machine that just gives you money for nothing. You just put money in and suddenly you have more money.
It's not?
It's not that. And what it is you're buying into a business. And sometimes businesses make profits and sometimes they lose money. And what you're trying to do is create good business practices when you're investing that money. When a lot of people are jumping into the market who have no idea what it means to be in the market, they don't know that they're owning businesses. They just think they've got accounts. I've got money in an account. That's not investing. You own a business, and that account has a dollar value associated with it that's just an estimate of what those businesses are worth in the proportion that you own them. As long as people recognize that, they treat it a lot more like they treat the appraisal on their house. Unless they're intending to sell their house this year, it's not that big a deal. They are owning it for a different reason. When a lot of people are jumping into the market that aren't aware of that, then we get irrational exuberance. And I like to nip that in the bud just as soon as we get it. And we just started really getting it. We talked about this last month. that we were watching the headlines and the optimism was taking over, and we're seeing lots of people looking forward and saying, yes, there's nothing that could go wrong. That scares us, because that's when euphoria starts after optimism. Having a correction now is the perfect time for it, because it's going to scare the people that don't need to be in the market,
well,
that don't know what they're buying. It scared them enough that some of them have left.
Well, about $30 million flowed last week out of...
$30 million? Million or billion? If it's $30 million, that's not a very big...
Well, out of mutual funds we're talking about. The net equity domestic mutual funds had a negative cash flow. I may be wrong, but I think it was $30 million. It may have been $30 billion. I think it was $30 million. And that's after the first month when we had record inflows into U.S. domestic equity mutual funds.
I've got an equity fund outflow of $23.9 billion.
Okay, so it's
according to Lipper.
Okay, yeah. It's billion.
Yeah.
Billion, million, pretty soon you have some real money here. Anyway, bunch of money.
When you got that many zeros, it's really nine zeros.
Look, I have trouble with 23,000. I told you earlier.
Yeah, the Dow is getting too big. We need to shrink it. Let's do a reverse split on the Dow.
That's why I follow the S&P 500. You know, basically I say, okay.
Until that gets too big, then what are you going to do?
We crossed the 2,500 mark on the S&P 500. We have not dipped below the 2,500 mark.
They just need to keep making new indexes that have smaller numbers so that we can comprehend them a little bit easier.
That's what they're doing with cryptocurrencies.
Oh, yeah, there you go.
you haven't heard much about Bitcoin lately because it's way down. Here's the point, and I think this: if you are a long-term investor, and I hope you are if you're listening to this program, there's a very important thing to recognize here. Forecasts are only forecasts, and bad things can happen that upset them, and good things can happen that upset them. But the big picture right now is that the United States economy has a sustainable growth rate, and it's a little over 2%. And that's if everything's going right. And there's a reason that for that sustainable growth rate, and it has to do with how many people we add in the workforce, what the productivity is, a host of things. Unless we invest a lot of capital, we have a sustainable growth rate of a little over 2%. Last quarter's rate of growth, now not for the quarter, but annualized, was 2.6. 2.3. This one is coming along at about 2.6, maybe higher the first quarter. We could see something in the upper twos, maybe 3% for 2018.
Let me throw out the warning. Repeatedly for the last, probably 8 years, the first quarter has taken a big hit.
Yes.
When a winter storm hits the Northeast.
Which hasn't happened this year.
Yeah, and it might happen. So that's the warning, is that the weather predictions are harder than economic predictions. And when you combine the two, oh boy. So barring a big shutdown of the Northeast.
But the big numbers for 2018 and 2019 look like we are going to do what's called above sustainable growth. In other words, we're going too fast. We'll be using up reserves. For instance, consumers right now are lessening their savings and increasing their spending. And if this continues, which a lot of economists think it's going to continue to accelerate in the near future, they'll get to the point, as they have at the top of booms in the past, where their savings rate goes negative. And at that point, we don't know when the end of that cycle is coming, but
we can tell it's coming.
It's coming at that point.
That's the end. That's the beginning of the end of the cycle.
And this is a massive. This is one for the textbooks. This is one for the history books, because never before in the history of the United States, at least, or since we've been tracking economies in the developed world, have we seen a point where we hit near full employment, where the economy is running along very nicely, and then we inject, in this particular case, $3 or $4 trillion worth of stimulus into it. Now, let me add this to that. If the president's infrastructure plan of $1.5 trillion goes through and he doesn't turn around and raise taxes, that will raise the 10-year deficit to 5.2 trillion additional deficit above what we would have had under the old law to $5.2 trillion. Man, if that doesn't, that will be one of the greatest experiments in the history of economics. Listen, let's take an engine that's already running pretty much at full speed
and let's put some nitro in it.
Dump some alcohol and gasoline,
nitrous oxide
into it and rev it up and see what happens.
Yeah. You're going to break some parts.
And
what's important here, and I'm going to throw this in here because we're talking about labor force participation. The number that we look at that's the number for that is from the Congressional Budget Office and the Labor Department. They come together with this idea about what is the labor force participation. Well, obviously, if you're in your 70s, the participation rate's pretty low. So we have to look at a group of adults that generally, if there's a group of adults that are going to be working, this is the group that it would be. So it's ages 25 to 54. That's a pretty good group of people. And if you think back, if those of you that were alive, I was not. In 1967...
I remember 1967.
Okay, 1967, this group of people, 25 to 54, 97% of the men in that group were working. Okay, hold that in your mind, 97%. Only 47% of the women were working. Okay, so obviously we've seen some changes there. In 2007, so we've come forward quite a bit from 1967, in 2007, 91% of the men in that group were working and 75% of the women. What that means is that the big boom that we saw in the 80s and 90s, the big changes that we saw during that time period, were we had this whole untapped workforce that was coming in. A great number of educated women were coming into the workforce. We come forward about 10 years, so into 2017. We were looking back at 2007. And that number is a really good one to look at because that's just before the downturn. That's just before the recession really hit. 91% of men were working, 75% of women in this age group. 88% of that same age group in men are working. So we've dropped 3% of the men. And 74% of the women. So that's within the error range. So it could be about the same for women. But it is slightly lower in the numbers. When we look at something that we hear about almost as a medical thing and we say, yeah, it's a problem, we got to fix that. When we're talking about revenue to the government, when we're talking about interest rates, it doesn't really come up in that conversation. So I'm going to throw it out there. The opioid crisis. This age group is the target age group for the opioid crisis. And depending on which numbers you look at, it's between 2 and 3% of the population in this group that have been hit by addiction to opioids that were prescribed to them. These aren't like going out to the junkie dealers and getting the heroin fix, although that comes later when people can't get the painkillers.
Actually, it was an orderly transfer from illegal opioid sales
to legal
to corporate opioid sales through physicians.
Right. And so when we say in 2007, 91% of this workforce, 25 to 54 per year old men, and now 88%, you can attribute a huge chunk of that difference to being hooked on drugs that it's not really the fault of the user of these drugs that they got hooked.
And a very significant part of that, if you want to see where the money's going on this is one of those fascinating things that I think that I've not read any big articles on. If you do any analysis on corporate profitability and corporate earnings, you'll discover that so-called healthcare corporations, some of them, mainly corporations in the United States that make medications, make drugs.
Right.
Have the most amazing profit margins, and they have been rising astronomically the past few years.
They don't have to compete on price.
And, well, they don't, not only that, but basically they're selling opioids. That's like heroin.
Yeah, of course you get high profits for selling opioids.
And they've discovered that
constant stream of income.
They're pushing hard to sell more and more opioids, and in many cases have the government pay for it.
Now, this is not some vast conspiracy between Big Pharma. That whole idea of Big Pharma is kind of ludicrous. It's like Big Tobacco. They are in a dog-eat-dog world, competitive with each other to no end. But if they don't have to compete on prices, it means that everybody can raise their rates and still compete with each other. Yeah. So there's a problem there. So when we're talking about the opioid crisis, when we're talking about the unemployment rate, we're not really at full employment. We're just close. If we could fix the opioid problem, we could grab another 3% of the prime workforce and throw them back into work. That would get rid of some of the deficit that we're seeing. It would get rid of the inflation problems that we're seeing, because we'd be creating new value.
If a frog had wings, it wouldn't bump his butt every time it hit the ground.
That's true. I'm just saying that there are some...
If we can get rid of the opioid crisis.
Yeah, there are some problems that are not being addressed. Social Security, the opioid epidemic, Medicare.
This is the funny thing. We could fix the opioid crisis.
And Social Security and Medicare.
No. Fixing the opioid crisis would not be... We've already got a solution. And it's already been put in place in a different area. We used to have really serious heroin addiction in cities. Now, federal government has funded methadone clinics in cities all across the United States, and the people who want to get back productive in the workplace, there is a treatment. Admittedly, it doesn't cure them, but it solves the problem. They become productive members of society again, but they get methadone, and they're not stoned, and they're not going through withdrawal. They just use methadone instead of heroin. And they get counseling, and it works out really, really well. The issue is that there was funding for that from the federal government, and it's still there. But for the rural areas where the opioid crisis is most severe,
they have to drive into the city, which can be 2 or 3 hours away.
They're not even eligible. They don't live in the geographic areas that are covered by the grants.
Right, because it was this concept of that the only people that use heroin must be the inner city.
Right.
Because this is a problem from the 80s and 90s. Well, we've switched that problem from being drug dealer related to being corporate drug creator related.
And it's an interesting thing. As the opioid crisis has worsened, the federal government's funding of rural health care has been chopped consistently year after year. And this is not just a Trump thing. This has been going on for a long time.
It's across the board.
And the whole thing is just kind of drying up. So it's fixable. It's just that it would require more spending.
Which is what we're complaining about at the moment.
Yeah, and somebody might have to pay some taxes on it. But there's a couple of big issues here.
We would save more money on the people going back to work than we would spend on it. And that's the kind of tax you want. One that inspires value creation
but you can't turn around and cut taxes across the board the way they've been cut and then turn around and say, oh yeah, we're going to raise them again, so they're not going to do it.
Well, you can cut taxes and then just increase spending. That's what they're doing. That's just a solution to everything, right?
So I guess the big picture that at least I want to tell you, and I think it's important to recognize, is the good times are probably going to continue to roll in the short term. By the way, it is a brilliant move. You can take it back to Bill Clinton's campaign where he said, is the economy stupid?
Well, he's not the only one that said that. There have been a lot of Republicans that use that as a mantra too.
Well, but that's the – it was big in his campaign.
Right,
it was
right.
The first time I saw it. But this is a brilliant move on the part of the Republicans and on the part of the president.
Reagan did it too for Carter. It's the economy stupid was a big, was a button from Reagan, which Clinton used as well.
But the point is that if you want to influence short-term election results and you want to really improve the chances that the Republicans will retain control of Congress, then you cut taxes and you really give a kick in the butt to the economy in 2018, 2019. Now, here's the problem, though. If Moody's is correct, 2020 If everything goes right, 2020 won't give us a recession, but it'll give us a pretty dramatic slowdown in growth that won't actually result quite in a recession, but we'll get a very, very slow growth year with high inflation. They may have just shot themselves in the foot because that's the presidential election year.
Yeah.
And people really turn out for presidential elections. So
yeah, and the market has a lot to do with how people vote.
The economy. Yeah. And it's the economy, stupid.
Yeah. Right. And although it's more the market than the economy, because when unemployment's up, it doesn't necessarily change the party. But if the market's down at the same time, people vote the other side.
So
it doesn't really matter who's in office. That's just something you can see across the board.
I wish I could say that we were smart enough to make that prediction. It's actually Mark Zandi at Moody's Analytics. That's the one side of it, but it's really important to recognize that he's the only guy who very consistently and very accurately have called major moves in the economy since the last 10 years.
We
got to do some commercials.
Yes, we do. If you'd like to join our conversation, this is the Personal Wealth Coach. I'm Jake McClure. This guy over here is
Jeff McClure.
The phone number to call in here is 254-773-1400. We'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And telephone number in here remains 254-773-1400. If today is February 10th, 2018, where you are, and it's turning cold in Central Texas and getting colder, and I think we've already had our high for the day or something.
Yes, we have already had the high for the day.
And
speaking
of
methadone clinics.
We've had the high for the – well, speaking of stock markets. there's we've been talking about the issues that have going on, and obviously there was a big correction. There's a couple of important things happened.
Correction in the market, yeah.
Yeah, there's a big correction in the market, about 10%. It only lasted one day because it don't.
So far, it could come back.
Well, it could be back. Would that be a second correction?
I don't know. I think I would call it the same one just because it's got one day in between. I would just call it a correction.
Yeah, well, Thursday at the close, it was down just over 10%, and then it was up 1.5% on Friday.
Do you think when it recovers from a correction, it's uncorrect?
It's definitely an uncorrection. Well, it's a negative correction. It's like negative growth. And we have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, guys, enjoy the show. I mean, obviously, with the volatility, there's something going on. How much of the volatility is program trades, and how much is somebody calling their broker and saying, hey, get me on the market, I'll hang up and miss it?
Okay, the answer to that question is D, all of the above.
Yeah. It's really hard to separate that out in some ways. In other ways, it's really easy. Program trading isn't what it used to be. There's big quant firms. They're called quant because they make quantitative decisions based on algorithms rather than based on fundamentals or even technicals. They're just this, I guess, it's an extreme form of technical using proprietary algorithms.
It's all Al Gore's fault.
Al Gore did it.
It's his rhythms.
Right. His rhythms are just rough on volatility. There's a lot less of the amateur calling their broker movement in the market. It still happens, but it's much more related to active management in 401ks and in 403bs and in the big hedge funds that are out there and the big quantitative funds. They're doing trades based on split second stuff, and that may have been the beginning of the downturn. The volatility that we saw was a bunch of people adding their voices to that. So that's why it's at the beginning, it's easy to tell, okay, volatility, this is from these program trading. But it's not a huge amount of volatility. It starts with some volatility, and then everybody starts adding their voice to the disharmony. And that's what we're seeing here, is that a lot of people have jumped on as well.
Anytime we have a long run-up in the market, there is some garbage that gets scattered around on the edges.
You don't know who's not wearing their swimming suit till the tide goes out.
There's a lot of evidence that in this particular market, there were people who were making bets using exchange-traded funds and exchange-traded notes on the volatility index. and they were betting it was going to remain low. And
when you bet the volatility is going to remain low and it goes the other way, it magnifies the volatility.
Right. And so what happened is people started losing, and these are very highly leveraged exchange trade notes, one of which completely collapsed, by the way, and went to zero.
People don't even know what exchange traded notes are.
Basically, exchange traded notes is something you should not get involved in unless you're extremely sophisticated, and even then you probably shouldn't.
These are notes that you don't want to share with the rest of the class.
You got that. You don't even want to have one. You can get in a lot of trouble. The teacher will definitely put you in the corner.
Much worse than chewing gum.
But what happened is it is pretty clear that people who lost a lot of money that they apparently had borrowed on exchange traded notes through Credit Suisse turn around and sold ETFs that were index ETFs, because it's pretty clear as this particular downturn occurred, and it kind of cascaded down.
It was across the market, kind of equal across the market.
The selling was like, hey, let's just take the S&P 500 and do a capital weighted selling across the S&P 500, which meant that index funds or ETFs were being sold. Now you can look at the index funds and see they were selling, but they weren't selling that fast. So a bunch of people dumped a bunch of exchange traded index funds,
probably in their 401ks and retirement funds and that sort of thing. But it could be elsewhere.
The other ones were the people who were doing the sophisticated trades. Now, as we mentioned earlier, 30 billion, roughly. Jake was quoting 26 billion. I saw a round figure in an article, $30 billion in this last week.
Is it 23.6?
Okay, so the range. I saw one that said 30
right,
billion.
30 billion outflow
from people. Those are individuals selling equity ETFs, equity
mutual
index
funds
mainly. The active funds, we're not seeing a big sell off. We're seeing a sell off in ETFs. Now there's a critical point here though. I was about to talk about this, and this brings me into it. Unless you've got something more to say about the volatility.
No.
Okay. Fidelity, Betterment, Schwab, and some other robo-advisors, they're called, where you sign up and you pay them 0.3% on the funds you have under management, and they have a robo-advisor that controls or tells you, either one, how you should allocate your funds, and you put it in index funds, and that's cool. This was the first correction we've had since these robo-advisors have been in place. And by the way, their promise is, hey, we're going to allocate your money in such a way as to minimize volatility and maximize your gains. Wealth without risk is what that's called, by the way. And then in the fine print, they say everything could fall apart, but you don't read the fine print. The major robo-advisor places where you do it yourself online, as far as I can tell, all of the major ones crashed during the downturn. And this was just a correction, and it was a relatively minor correction. It wasn't a panic. It was just kind of a stumble or a blip. It's something that historically has happened a couple of times a year going back, and the fact we've gone a long time without one. But this is a crucial thing to note, is that this methodology where for a very, very small amount of money, very low expense, you can buy into low expense index funds, and using a computer algorithm that will allocate your money in such a way as to minimize your risk and maximize your gains. And you say, cool. And it worked for a couple of years because we didn't have any volatility and the market went up, and more money poured into there, and more money poured out of manually managed accounts where investment advisors were managing the accounts. And then when people went to check on their balances to see how badly they'd crashed, they made an interesting discovery. The system they were using to manage their money had crashed.
Yeah. And when there's a fascinating thing here. AI is pretty amazing. Anybody that's listened to us for very long know that we're very future aware. We've been called futurists. We look out at what's coming and we're very excited. AI for cars that will drive the car for you is a lot easier to write. It's a lot easier to measure for than AI for the market. Because AI for cars, there's a written rule book. The only areas that's difficult for AI right now are when people come to a four-way stop sign. because even though there's a written rule book, none of us follow it. We just look at each other and somehow we know which one goes next. Well, the computer hasn't quite gotten that figured out. They're working on it. So AI for cars, it's taking the biggest and the best software companies in the world a decade to get to as far along as we are now. When we talk about AI for the market, that's supposed to cover all trades, supposed to go, there's no rule book. There's just some opinions going in, generally in very small firms. When the AI starts getting written, the firm's generally pretty small. They're getting bigger now, but there's no rule book to say the best way to buy or to sell. And in the event that there ever is a rule book that's made, it has to be tested in large market situations or the rule book might be wrong. So even the platform, the software platform that runs the AI, if it crashes, then there are problems. And this is what you were just talking about here, is that the platform itself crashed. You couldn't actually make a buy or a sell order during this time period because the software wasn't working. Just imagine if the car is being driven by itself and the software stops working. It needs to be a little bit more tested before general public use.
Well, I don't know. There's one that's actually cruising around the sun right now.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's what I mean.
Definitely a self-driving car.
The AI for self-driving cars is a lot further along than the AI for market stuff. Because if it's not tested in, you know, the Tesla self-driving situation, it still requires. It says all over, you need to be paying attention, hands on the wheel, looking around. Unless you're in a parking lot.
In which case, you just call your car and it comes to you.
Right. And that whole concept of...
Tesla
manual control of an automatic process, that's not what happens in the market in a lot of cases.
You know, Tesla is on the way and soon will break all previous records for having miles for a self-driving vehicle.
Yeah.
Greatly
cruising
exceeding
across the solar system. Yes. Yes.
And the chances of it actually hitting another car.
It's impossible. The AI is so good. They don't even have the AI turned on, and it's not going to hit another car.
You know they don't have the AI turned on?
Because they don't have a way of keeping it powered for long enough.
Well, they could be solar cells.
They're not.
But there's a dummy in the car.
There is. Well, there's a mannequin. I don't think it's politically correct to call him a dummy anymore.
It's not a crash dummy?
No, he is a mannequin. He might get offended if he's paying attention.
Well, no, that's sexist, though, mannequin.
Yeah, it is. It is. Or at least handist.
Something. Anyway, back to the issue of volatility and what is going on with the volatility. There's something that is worth being concerned about, at least I think. And I may mention this again because I think it's very important. I remember 1987 very, very clearly because it was only the other day. And
it was another day. You're right there.
And I remember that early in 1987, we had kind of a hiccup in the market, a correction.
A hiccup? That's like an acid reflux.
It wasn't like a heart attack. It was like a hiccup. We had a little correction.
It was a definitely needed prescription for
that hiccup. During the correction, something that was called portfolio insurance didn't quite work properly, and then they got it back working again and said, no problem. And as a result, people... because it partially failed and was fixed and didn't cause a disaster, people really started jumping on it in a more accelerated rate as the year went on. And then the market started shooting up because people felt more confident because they could allocate their money and position their money in such a way that they would minimize their risk in the market.
Yeah, it was foolproof, except that everybody was fools, and you can't be foolproof, really.
And we recently had a tax cut, so at least a major tax law passed the year before. Does this sound familiar? The last time we passed a major tax law was in 1986. It went into effect in 1987. So now we got a new tax law that supposedly cuts taxes in a lot of areas. The market is soaring. It had a little hiccup. It has a system in it that is becoming very, 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 very popular that theoretically reduces risk. And come August, if we are in the stratosphere in the market, then I wouldn't be at all surprised to see that sometime by mid-October, we will be crying in our beer if we drink beer. If you don't drink beer, you can still go cry in it.
Right.
And I don't know that that's going to happen. I just know that the patterns associated with 1987 seem to be at least rhyming, if not repeating themselves, in 2018. So this is one of those things to just be aware of. And the other thing is, you might say, well, okay, well, if this is coming, I'm going to get out of the market. No, I would not recommend that. What I'm saying is, one of the things about the 1987 market crash and Black Monday and all the panic that occurred is 18 months later, we were in positive territory again and charging upward. And that was kind of the opening round in what is arguably one of the greater bull markets in the history of the United States. So right. I'm not saying get out of the market. I'm simply saying, as a matter of fact, to quote Barron's, fasten your seatbelt, because
volatility is a normal part of the market.
But
it's
been
absent for a while.
At the very, very low volatility that we've seen over the past couple of years, reversion of the mean is a fascinating thing. We've had there seems to be an economic rule or law that says the higher the growth, the greater the variance or volatility.
Right.
We've had high growth with low volatility, but these things tend to get paid for.
High volatility and no growth for a while.
We could have high growth and high volatility, but we've got some volatility deficit to make up, and I suspect later on in the year we're going to see some exciting.
Those of you that were involved in the market in 2009 through 2011 saw day to day, every day was very similar to what we've seen in the past week. And we just got used to it. So keep that in mind as well. We're about out of time for this hour. We've got another hour coming up after this to talk more about the economy. We'll talk about oil and natural gas. There's some big news in that front. We'll talk about gold and other specie. Do you have anything in mind to talk about next hour?
Well, I think armadillos.
Armadillos?
That's a species.
Yeah, that's a different kind of species.
Oh, okay. I have lots of things to talk about.
Good.
So
if you would like to talk to us off the air, we actually do give personalized custom investment advice to people with high net worth. The number to call to reach us, we've got voicemail during the weekend, real life people during the week. The local number is
254-947-1111.
And if you want to reach that toll free, it's 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can email us directly, Jeff or Jake at tpwc.com. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com, to listen to podcasts, read newsletters, look at our philosophy and our fantastic staff, as well as our made for radio faces. Until next hour, this is the Personal Wealth Coach.
Yum. Serving Central Texas, KTEM AM, Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.